This week on Making Contact.
It's impossible for us to have a viable self-governing society. It's impossible for us to have social justice with this type of media system. It's just not going to happen.
What we learn through the news media shapes how we choose our elected officials. In a democracy, we expect the media to serve the public interest. On this special Election Watch 04 edition, we'll take a look at how media companies are influencing the political process. We'll also hear from media critic and author Robert McChesney, who says the media's complicity with the government impacts the health of democracy in the United States. I'm Amy Pomerleau, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. An important prerequisite for free and fair elections is a media that can provide a diversity of information about candidates and issues. In the past 20 years, media ownership has consolidated to the point where only a handful of companies control the news business. As correspondent Justin Beck reports, not only does election coverage suffer, media companies are tainting the political process itself through campaign contributions.
When voters go to the polls in November, what they know about candidates and issues will largely be shaped by what they see, hear, and read in the media. According to a study by the Pew Research Center, most Americans get their news from local TV coverage.
They rely on TV news to help them become citizens.
Celia Wexler is vice president for advocacy at Common Cause, a watchdog group that tracks donations made by corporations to political parties.
And one of the things you rely on TV news for is to explain to you when there are local elections or any elections underneath the presidential level, congressional elections, state elections, then at the local level, what the candidates stand for.
Increasingly, these TV stations, along with radio stations, newspapers, and magazines, are owned by a few powerful corporations. This is made possible by government deregulation. In the TV business, it's been happening for the past two decades.
Deregulation historically over the last 20 years, and it really began in full force during the first term of the late President Ronald Reagan. Deregulation of the television industry started in about 1983, and it's really been a constant wave since then.
Jeff Chester is the executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy.
The big media companies in the United States have had, individually as a private corporation and collectively in their industry-specific area, whether it's cable or newspapers or broadcasting, they've had a political agenda fairly well-defined over the last two decades, and that is to roll back or eliminate any of the public policies that they believe restrict their ability to buy more properties and operate without any kind of requirements or regulation.
Meanwhile, as media companies have grown their corporate empires, they've spent millions on politics. Celia Wexler of Common Cause says it's all about buying access and influence in government.
Those campaign contributions open the doors. They get you into the highest circles of government where policy is made.
Let's take a look at some of the numbers Wexler provided. Between 1995 and 2003, the Walt Disney Company, which owns ABC, and General Electric, which owns NBC, each gave more than $5 million in soft money to national political parties and federal candidates. While these companies hedge their bets by giving to both Democrats and Republicans, donations by other media companies reveal a clear bias toward right-wing politics. For example, in the same period, Clear Channel donated more than $300,000 to Republicans, nearly three times what it gave to Democrats. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, owner of Fox News, donated $2.4 million to Republicans, more than four times what it gave to Democrats. Neither company agreed to an interview for this story. Timothy Carr is the executive director of MediaChannel.org, an alliance of independent media organizations. He says the bulk of political contributions by media companies goes to Republicans.
I would say around 62% of all of their political contribution goes to regulation-hostile Republicans. And it makes sense, given their own objectives to increase their corporate bottom line. Why support candidates who have come out in favor of regulating big media?
Some media critics say big media companies have a clear political agenda. Mark Cooper is the director of research at the Consumer Federation of America. He says this agenda has translated into outright censorship.
I think the fiction that, you know, it doesn't matter who owns the station, they're just reporting the news, clearly has been shown to be somewhat false if you look at, you know, a series of recent decisions running from Disney deciding not to release Fahrenheit 911 to Sinclair refusing to show the Nightline, which showed the coffins and the pictures of soldiers, to Clear Channel blackballing the Dixie Chicks for criticizing the war. The fiction that the media is unbiased is gone. The media takes political positions, and in cities where you have a dominant media owner, it skews the public policy debate.
Support for media deregulation within the Federal Communications Commission is by no means unanimous. The agency is made up of five commissioners appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. Currently, the FCC has a majority of Republican commissioners. Jonathan Adelstein is one of the two Democratic commissioners who opposed the FCC's proposals last year that would have further relaxed ownership rules. When it comes to the effect concentration of ownership has had on the media's coverage of elections, Adelstein's view is unequivocal.
We see a pitifully small amount of serious coverage of elections or news and public affairs. So there's less real debate that goes on. There's less creativity as a result. There's less freshness, I think, in some of the content that people are seeing. You create a new Citizen Kane in that community with that kind of control.
About the same time the government began deregulating the TV industry more than two decades ago, media critic Ben Bagdikian published his landmark book, The Media Monopoly. Since then, the number of corporations dominating the U.S. media has dwindled from 50 to just five: General Electric, Time Warner, Disney, Viacom, and News Corp. Bagdikian cites Clear Channel as an example of how media consolidation can lead to disastrous results. In the early 1990s, the company owned 40 radio stations, the upper limit allowed at that time by the FCC. The 1996 Telecommunications Act lifted the cap on the number of stations one company could own, and Clear Channel began buying them up by the hundreds. Today, the company owns more than 1,200 radio stations in the U.S. When a toxic chemical spill occurred in the town of Minot, North Dakota in 2002, local authorities tried to notify residents of the danger by issuing an alert on the town's seven radio stations. Six of those stations were owned by Clear Channel. When officials arrived at the stations, the lights were on, but nobody was home.
All six of those stations in Minot were locked, empty, and broadcasting. But they're broadcasting canned stuff from thousands of miles away. So that the people of that community had almost zero access to their own radio stations.
Some opponents of media consolidation would like to see this issue addressed in the months leading up to the election. Jeff Chester of the Center for Digital Democracy doubts this will happen.
I am concerned that media ownership is not going to be a part of the debate in the presidential election, because both Senator Kerry and President Bush are ultimately beholden to and have worked on behalf of the special media lobby. Senator Kerry has a long track record in supporting the interests of the cable industry, for example. He has supported the wireless industry. Senator Kerry's brother works for one of the biggest cable industry lobbying organizations. A former key staff member of Senator Kerry works for the same cable lobbying firm. Up until now, Senator Kerry has not really made media an issue. Of course, George Bush is the leading proponent of further consolidation and deregulation. And so the public is unlikely, in the absence of effective advocacy from the public interest community, to have any kind of meaningful debate or chance of potential change come November. Media is simply off the table at the moment.
Bagdikian is somewhat more optimistic.
If Kerry gets in, one thing that'll happen is he appoints the majority of the FCC, And that kind of imbalance, presumably, would change. And what he would do about the big companies, I think, remains to be seen.
While high-profile issues like the war against Iraq and the economy continue to dominate election coverage, and with little incentive for mainstream media to take on the issue, chances are slim for media reform to receive much attention this election cycle. For Making Contact, I'm Justin Beck.
We'll have more about media and elections in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Robert McChesney is professor of communications at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's the author of 8 books. The latest is The Problem of the Media, U.S. Communication Politics in the 21st Century. Speaking in Berkeley, California in May 2004, McChesney addressed the decline in the overall quality of reporting in the commercial media, from the war in Iraq to political campaigns.
What we're seeing today in the United States is the collapse of viable, accountable self-government in any meaningful sense. Sheer, utter collapse. What we're seeing is an element and a degree of corruption that comes with the collapse of self-government. It's axiomatic. Self-government, legitimate governance declines, corruption goes up. It's true everywhere. We're seeing that take place to staggering degrees in the United States today. And the problems with our governance are very much a media problem. Media are built right into all these problems we're talking about. They aren't the only cause, but any solution of this problem has to go through media, changing our media system. It's impossible for us to have a viable self-governing society. It's impossible for us to have social justice with this type of media system. It's just not going to happen. We don't change one first and the second follows. We change them both together. We do them hand in hand. And let's just talk about 2 or 3 of the areas where we see the crisis in our society and the crisis of our media overlap and become interchangeable. First, the decision to go to war. What more important decision is there for society than whether to engage in war, to kill people, to devote enormous resources to invading countries and occupying them? The United States, our fair country, over the last 100 years has done this more than a couple times. I don't know the exact numbers, roughly 70 or 80 times we've gone into some foreign country. Now, most of these are these quickie carpet bombings. Most of us, they happen overnight. You don't even know about them the next day. But on a handful of occasions in the last 100 years, we've had major wars overseas that involved our troops. Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the Central American proxy wars of sorts in the 1980s, the first Gulf War, and of course the war, the invasion and occupation of Iraq. And if you're a journalist and you study our history, or if you're a citizen and you study our history, what we learn in almost every one of these cases, up till 2002, in almost every one of these cases, we had a situation where the President of the United States wanted to go to war. He determined, for whatever reason, I want to go to a certain war here. But the American people didn't want to go to war. They were not enthusiastic about going to a particular war. Now, the President had a couple options then. The President could try to convince the American people of the wisdom of his, and it's a his in all these cases, his choice to go to war. Or the President could lie and try to con people into supporting him in the war effort. I regret to say that almost all our presidents opted for Plan B. They decided to lie. And then this measure for the media is how good of a job do they do of holding the President accountable so these lies can't be gotten away with. That's the measure of the media. Boy, if the media flunks that one, it's really flunking like one of the most important tests it's got. I mean, what good is a free press if you can't get the truth out of people who want to take you to war and kill people, including yourself? What good is it? Well, I regret to say it flunked that test. The media generally went along with it. And in at least 2 of the cases, World War I and Vietnam, led to disastrous wars that absolutely wouldn't have taken place had the American people not been propagandized and lied to by the government with the willing support of the bulk of the news media. Then turn to 2002. Along comes our current president, George W. Bush, with grand claims about terrorism and Saddam Hussein, with grand claims about weapons of mass destruction that are an imminent threat to the United States, such an imminent threat that by international law they justify an invasion of this country throwing out the government to occupy it because there's an imminent threat from weapons of mass destruction. And you would think any self-respecting journalist looking at the last 100 years of American history, as soon as a president starts trotting in with all sorts of big arguments for going to war, first thing you do is reach for your wallet. First thing you do is say, okay, time out, time to bring in some skepticism here before we go off in another one of these bogus wars we always get dragged into. You'd think that, right? Regrettably, that didn't take place. In fact, nothing close to that took place. We now know that our press coverage was arguably the worst in American history. Arguably the worst in American history. And one way to measure the problem of our media system and that and how poorly it's responded to this crisis is to consider that 1 year ago at this time, a New York Times reporter named Jason Blair was summarily run out of the profession. Jason Blair was on the cover of Newsweek magazine. He was on all the cable news shows talking about him. He was the subject of talk radio. He became an instant celebrity. Jason Blair was run out of his job at the New York Times because he was discovered to have fudged stories, to have made up quotes, to have lied in his journalism. You couldn't trust what he had said. And he had written scores, hundreds of stories over the years for the New York Times. It was such a scandal that the two top editors of the New York Times had to resign in shame for having promoted and sponsored Jason Blair's career. Now, what Jason Blair did was wrong. He deserved to lose his job. You can't have journalists doing that. But consider that at the same time Jason Blair is being run out of the profession with tremendous fanfare, another New York Times reporter named Judith Miller was filing story after story about weapons of mass destruction that were an imminent threat to the United States. Stories based on single sources, apparently not checked very closely, with a strong interest in promoting this war. We now know, and the New York Times would soon acknowledge when it was too late, that these stories were not especially accurate. But they were instrumental in fomenting popular support, and especially elite support for the claims for this war. Well, gosh, the New York Times is covering this. It must, you know, even though there's not much evidence for it, well, it must be true. The New York Times has got it in there. But Judith Miller still has her job. Judith Miller still appears on cable news shows as an expert on Iraq and other subjects. But I will tell you that when Jason Blair and Judith Miller both meet their maker, Judith Miller is going to have a lot more to answer for. Now, I think in addition to the decision to go to war, another crucial measure of our media system, especially of our journalism, is how it covers elections. And we're in an election year this year, and some of these wonderful educational political ads that they've graciously given us, but you really can measure a free press by the quality of your democracy. If you have a lousy electoral system, before you know anything about your media system, if your electoral culture is deeply flawed, not working, you know you've got a problem with your media, because that's really where the rubber hits the road on a free press, how your electoral democracy works, how your self-governance works. If it's not working, no amount of BS helps you. Your media system is flawed, period, because that's the whole point of a free press in a democratic society, period. So let's just, before we talk about media, let's look at the caliber of our electoral democracy right now. What's the voting turnout rate in the United States? Granted, it's not a pure way to describe or understand or comprehend popular participation, but it's not a bad place to start. Our voting participation rate's roughly 50% in presidential election years, goes down to the high 30s, roughly, in off years, mid to high 30s in the off-year elections. In an odd number of years, depending on the state, it usually goes down to between 5 and 10% to 35, 40, 45% at the very high end in lunatic places like Minnesota. What do we know about the people who vote? Is it a random selection of Americans who just say, I'll vote this year, and other people say, I won't? No, what we know is that it's not a random selection. Voting in the United States, the best way to understand it is a class-based phenomenon. Voting in the United States is a class-based phenomenon. In the 2000 election, roughly half the voters came from the richest 20% of the population. Roughly half the voters came from the richest 20% of the population. Tom Patterson, the Harvard University political scientist who wrote a book called The Vanishing Voter that was published, I think, last year or the year before, argues that the difference between the United States and European electoral democracies that in this country, the working class doesn't vote. Poor people don't vote. Remember when John Edwards was running for president? And John Edwards is saying, you know, there's 40 or 50 million people who don't have any health coverage. We've got to come up with a way to protect them, he'd say. And then he'd say, now none of them vote. So you know, I know I'm not getting any votes for having this policy, but it's just the right thing to do. I'll appeal to your better instincts. That's an astonishing statement. 50 million people don't vote, but we ought to do a policy just to help them out. Well, why don't they vote? But I've got a couple ideas here worth noting about the election coverage. First of all, not many of our races are contested. A lot of that's due to gerrymandering. They got a map so you can really rig elections, so there's virtually no closely contested races anymore. John Nichols, my friend, asked him how many of the 435 U.S. House of Representative races would actually be competitive this year, whether really either candidate, and there are two candidates, have a shot at winning right now in November. How many of those aren't already known who the winner is going to be? He said roughly 10 or 12 out of 435. As Michael Moore likes to put it, he went back and looked at in history, there was more turnover in the Politburo under Stalin than there is in our House of Representatives. There was more turnover in the Politburo under Stalin. So you've got this spectacular gerrymandering, and the other thing that reinforces it is the amount of money that goes to politics, the immense amount of money that goes to candidates. Being a candidate for office today means two things. Either you're a Broadway producer looking to raise money constantly, or you're so rich you don't have to be a Broadway producer. Those are your two options. It's all about the money. It's going to be roughly $3 billion spent on federal races this year, 40% or 50% more than 2000, which was 40% more than 1996, which was 40% more than 1992. An immense amount of money that goes to these races. And if we didn't have gerrymandering, it'd probably be five times that. Imagine what it would be if we actually had competitive races in all those House districts. Where does this money come from? Well, first of all, understand that roughly 95 or 96% of the American people don't ever give money to candidates. There's really only 4 or 5% of the American people that make campaign contributions to candidates. And understand that of the individual campaign contributions that go to candidates, the overwhelming majority, roughly 80%, come from the wealthiest 1% of Americans. In fact, 1/2 of 1% of Americans. And then put the third fact here, that whoever has the most money wins the election, the race overwhelmingly. And you come up with the disastrous truth of American politics. Whichever candidate wins the wealth primary, meaning they collect the most money long before the actual election takes place, almost always wins the election once we get a chance to get in there. So once you win the wealth primary, you get the winner, and then we get to vote later to ratify, but the 4% who give all the money have already determined for us. That's how the system works. Now, when you understand it that way, the question isn't why do only 50% of the American people vote? It's why do that many people possibly vote? What irrational impulse would drive someone to vote in this system when the races are gerrymandered out and the big monies win? That's the logical question. It's a real testament, I think, to Americans' actual commitment to public life that many of our population vote. I think we should be proud of that figure. Yeah, exactly. Stand up for that. You know it. And where does this money go? Where does all this $3 billion going to go to? Well, the vast majority of it's going to go to pay for TV ads, TV political ads. A lot of people complain about the negative ads, you know, the ones where they trash Kerry for not being patriotic, or Kerry for driving an SUV, or Kerry for wearing ribbons, or whatever the crimes he's latest committed. I like the negative ones more than the positive ones. The positive ones where they're like playing with their dog and they're playing football with their grandmother. I mean, those I think are even more insulting than the negative ones. I mean, those are the most appalling ones. At any rate, what these ads do, besides just totally distorting our elections, is promote a cynicism, which is, I think, entirely justified. Now, what's the role of our media in this electoral environment? Where's the measure of our press? Right now, we're starting off, we've got some real problems with our press system. How does the press system, our journalism, respond to this situation? Well, it's really got two choices, our press system does. The first choice is, it could elect to counteract these tendencies aggressively. So it could say, we're going to aggressively cover the candidates that don't get much money, the candidates who don't do well in the wealth primary with the 4% who give all the money, but who might be really popular with the 96% of the people who live in this country who don't take part in the wealth primary. We're not going to let the big money determine who gets covered. We're going to cover the candidates who don't get a lot of money and really expose them to the general population. Along those lines, it could also say, we're not going to let TV ads paid for through the wealth primary by the wealthy candidates who get all the money from the 2 or 3% of the population determine what the news stories we're going to cover as the issues in the campaign. Instead, we're going to go out and talk to the 96% of the population that doesn't give any money and see what really interests them, what the issues that concern them, and make those the issues of the campaign. That's one option they could take. I'm not going to keep you in suspense. They didn't take that option. No, instead they took the exact opposite option. They said, we're only going to honor as legitimate candidates, candidates who get through the wealth primary. If you flunk the wealth primary, take a hike, pal. You're not a serious candidate. It's just the way it is. We're only going to take serious issues, issues that candidates pay for in TV ads. I mean, it's becoming patently absurd now that our debate in this presidential race is a volley of these TV ads, what one candidate says and what the ad says in reply. That is our political culture today. Mm-hmm. It's totally absurd. And as that has happened, understand the role of our media with regard to this. Our media companies, as they've increasingly sold these TV ads, have become the number one opponent of campaign finance reform. The average commercial television station today gets 12 or 13% of its revenues from TV candidates' ads. 12 or 13% of its revenues total come from TV candidate ads at a commercial TV station. In 1992, it was 3%. Do the math, 3% to 12 or 13%. This is a golden egg for these guys. This is a cash cow. The big four media companies that own our four networks, the four largest media companies in the world, by the way, that also all own film studios, those four companies are to campaign finance reform with the NRA as to gun control. They stop it at every corner. They are the number one lobby that makes sure we're going to have big money rule our system. And what's striking is that as this cash cow has increased, the coverage of candidates on our broadcast television and radio has virtually disappeared. Virtually disappeared, especially local races and local candidates, simply not covered. If you can't pay your way in, you're just simply not going to be covered. I mean, as I'll talk about a little bit later, perhaps, and certainly I write about in the book, there hardly have any radio journalism at all anymore in this country. Radio journalism, except in public radio and community radio, has virtually disappeared, except in a handful of stations in the largest markets. You know, it wasn't too long ago in a city like Washington, D.C., in the early 70s, you had 20 full-time radio journalists, not covering the Capitol, but covering the community of Washington, D.C., on radio. You had 20 full-time radio journalists. Today, I think they've got one or two, probably just reading the morning paper over the air, which is what they call journalism radio. As for local television news, local television news, I mean, the less said, the better. I mean, you know, I travel around the country, and I talk to people all the time. I get a real sense of this country. And we live in a very diverse society today. I think we're all aware of that. Lots of immigrants coming in, different cultures, religions, languages. We have people with very varied interests. We're actually a very heterogeneous society, despite all the homogeneity pushed on us by the commercial culture. I found the one thing that unites all Americans. Every American thinks their local television news is the worst in the nation. That's sort of our defining feature today. At any rate, what we have is an electoral system in crisis and a media system that accentuates it, reinforces it, and has to be changed if we're going to ever have electoral democracy that works in this society. It will require structural change.
That was Robert McChesney, author of the book, The Problem of the Media, U.S. Communication Politics in the 21st Century. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to production intern Eric Klein. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production funded primarily by individual contributors. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you'd like to support our work, or if you have suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. For a cassette or CD copy of the program, Election Watch 04, All the News That's Fit to Buy, program number 2804, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Justin Beck associate producer, Susanna Hines associate manager, Brishan McKee office manager, Peggy Law founding director, Norman Solomon senior advisor, David Barsamian national advisor, and I'm your host and director of production and training, Amy Pomerleau.